All right, I think what better way to start a Friday morning than talking about dynamic risk management? And I'm handing over to Zeki to kick us off.
Thank you, Sue. And as you all know, in September's board meeting, the staff presented some potential refinements to the core DRM model, aimed to align the model itself closer to the entity's risk management strategy by incorporating the risk concept of risk limits. Agenda Paper 4A repeats those refinements, accompanied with some further discussions relating to the feedback and comments the board gave from the September meeting, and we didn't introduce any new refinements. The staff's recommendations are summarized in the paragraph 4 of the Agenda Paper 4A. As a reminder of those issues, the original issue, including the risk limits in the DRM model, this was set out in paragraph 6 and paragraph 7 of this paper. Almost all outreach participants suggest the board to consider the risk limits in the DRM model because their interest rate risk management is based on a range of acceptable outcomes through the use of risk limits rather than just a single outcome target. So consistent with the September's board meeting and the paper we actually submitted for that meeting, the staff then discussed further the details of those refinements as set out in paragraph 8 to paragraph 35 of this paper. These refinements include the change of the target profile definition and the introduction of the risk mitigation intention, as well as a result of those two changes, the change of the construction of benchmark derivatives. The refinements also include the prospective assessment at the beginning of each period, as set out in paragraph 20 of this paper. And the purpose of that is to ensure the DRM model is used for risk mitigation purpose only and helps the entity to achieve its target profile. This is further supplemented by the use of retrospective assessment at the end of each period, for the purpose to capture the effect of unexpected change. And these are set out in paragraphs 30 to 35. Based on these potential refinements, the staff then discussed the misalignments and how misalignment can be determined in the DRM model. And we also highlighted the difference between determining the misalignment and communicating the impact of those misalignments through the profit and loss account via this so-called law of test, and the detail of those are set out in paragraphs 36 to 44. During the September's meeting, some of the board members actually asked us to look at ways to ensure the robustness of the application of the DRM model, and in particular, the robustness around the introduction of the risk mitigation intention. Paragraph 45 and 48 sets out staff view on this particular topic. And this is then followed by paragraph 49 to 57, where the staff summarized the potential benefits of those refinements. With that, I will now turn over to the board and ask whether you agree with the staff's recommendation to make the refinements as set out in paragraph 4 of this agenda paper. Thank you.
Thank you, Zeki. Good morning, everyone. Today.
Thank you, Andreas, and thank you to the staff for the very comprehensive and good solution that is in the paper. Some questions. One very simple question, but I understood from some parts of the text that once I have applied the macro hedge, let's say, or DRM model, I can't apply hedge for the other areas of the balance sheet, because it sees that this is seen as an entire one. Just to collect one sentence on paragraph 48. When applying the DRM model, entities can no longer designate derivatives against a gross position. My question is more in the case of, I'm just thinking, in the case of a group, that you might have more, similar to the discussion we have for business model, you might have kind of a segregation that you may have And then for this one, I'm applying the DRM model, but for the other part, I'm not. Is it possible?
Yeah.
It is. How does it actually interact with the arguments for the robustness of the risk mitigation intention? I mean, that if someone just tried to segregate a portfolio in order to, okay, I'm applying the old-fashioned way, that is designated gross position for this part, then I can manage. And for this one, I'm applying the DRM model.
You cannot designate the same item for the same risk in two models. So you cannot do that in DRM and then go and say, well, I want to do this for micro hedge accounting as well. But you can always hedge one item for more than one risk. So you might put something in the DRM model for interest rate risk, but for FX or something else, you hedge them in a micro hedge. So that still applies. So when we talk about you cannot designate something on a gross basis, it's for the things that are in DRM within the DRM model. It's not the other risks or the other items that are not in the model.
But therefore, I can have in the same financial statements, DRM model applied, and some other hedges for other. Okay. Well, another question I have on more to understand. In paragraph 25, when you refer to actual externalization, is it talking about disclosure or actually the derivatives that I'm using?
Okay. Yeah, that's
the way
using.
To external.
It has to be an external facing derivative, not internal derivatives.
Okay. In the end of the day, it's a kind of proof.
Yeah.
Because you have to have the derivative. Okay. And the unexpected changes. It might probably have be discussed before, but is it clear the concept of unexpected changes?
I would say yes.
But you would, wouldn't you?
But I think what we mean with unexpected changes is when I've set up my, I've determined my current net open risk position, which is all the things that I've grouped together to be hedged. Out of that, I designate my risk management intention. So I know how much I've designated out of this. Unexpected changes is there's a change in that which I haven't expected because my current net open position is based on expected changes and repricing. If it's outside of that, then, that's what we mean with unexpected changes. There was more prepayments, for example, or there was a bigger growth in the book than I expected.
And the final question on effectiveness test, retrospective effectiveness test. We refer to cumulative basis. And then for having cumulative basis, I have to have the at inception concept. Just one question, because I understood that we work with bucket times, and this would be the inception, the beginning of each of the bucket times that I have determined. And it means that in terms of the documentation, it has to be very clear, these buckets, what is the inception, because this is fundamental for getting the effectiveness test ready. Correct. Is it?
Yes, but I think we need to distinguish between the assessment, which is based on a bucket-by-bucket comparison, period-on-period. So the change during the period, that's what I'm using for my assessment bit itself. Measurement is going to be based on a cumulative measurement like we do currently. But I need to know what was in the bucket at the beginning of that period, and I need to know what's at the bucket at the end of the period, and I can compare those two to determine my retrospective assessment.
Each. And then, therefore, I would have... In 1 year, I would have 3, 4, 5 buckets, different buckets. Each one would be assessed. That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Right. That's the separate for each of the buckets for which the bucket purpose.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Leo. Good job.
Thank you, Andreas. As Tadio said, I think it's a very well drafted paper, and I agree with those refinements. I think in order to address the concern raised by those outreach participants, particularly the target profile would not be a single outcome, and it could be a range of the risks. You know, so I think I agree with the staff to change the definition of the target profile to focus on the range, you know, the risk limit, and also introduce the new new element of risk mitigation intention, and define it as the extent to which an entity intend to, you know, mitigate the current net open risk position through, you know, those derivatives. My first comment is actually about the wording recommendation, because we introduced the notion of the current net open risk position. Actually, the current net open risk position could change over time. So I think specify the date the current net open risk position is based is very important, because when we talk about the current net open risk position in the definition of the risk mitigation intention, I think it means the current net open risk position at the beginning of the reporting period or at the designation date. And when we're talking about misalignment, because at the end of the day, you need to compare risk mitigation intention with the current net open risk position at the end of the reporting period. But that is another, you know, current net open risk position, because it has been changed. So I think when we're talking about this notion, hopefully we can clearly, you know, identify which date we're talking about, you know. That is very important, because for accountant, they need to compare those numbers. This is the first wording suggestion. Second is about, because based on our model, risk mitigation intention could be changed. So I think specify in what kind of situation risk mitigation intention will be changed is very important. Based on the paragraph 26, it really depends on the frequency of the changes to the underlying portfolio with which the entity is making decisions about risk mitigation. And paragraph 26 gives two examples. One is that sometimes you need to designate a large or smaller position of the current net open risk mitigation. It's very understandable, because I said that current net open risk position could be changed over time. So you need to redesignate it. Secondly, another example is about trading new derivatives. Actually, it's also understandable, because you need to acquire or designate new derivatives. Just the wording, because we use wording, trading new derivatives. Some people, we misunderstanding, okay, we are going to using, you know, some derivatives for trading purpose, something like that. I think in my understanding here, those new derivatives actually you acquired from outside, but should be designated for dynamic risk management purpose rather than trading purpose, because we're using the wording of the trading, but it's better to clarify a little bit further. So I think add some clarification and discipline on which situation, you know, risk mitigation intention could be changed is very important. Third is, I also agree with staff's, you know, retrospective assessment and prospective assessment, and also agree with, you know, how to determine the misalignment, and not all the impact of misalignment would be recognized in PIL. It really depends on the law of the test. In my understanding, the combination of the cumulative changes in the value of the benchmark derivatives and the effect of the unexpected changes in the current net open risk position during the period, if that combination exceeds the accumulated fair value changes of designated derivative, that part will not be recognized. But in, from my perspective, that particularly that unexpected changes, that information is still very, I think it's still very useful. So I understand the staff are going to explore further potential disclosures in this regard. I agree, I think we should explore because those information will not be recognized. But from my perspective, I think that information is still very, very important because it's related to misalignment. So I hope that we can explore whether there are any feasibility. We can develop some kind of disclosure requirement in this regard. Thank you.
Thank you,
Chi-Chan.
Sue?
Thanks. So I think I agree with the overall direction of where we're going here. I had a few observations, a couple of suggestions, and then one question. So, firstly, in terms of observations, I like the fact that I think we're using ideas which are consistent with a lot of the thinking that we've got in IFRS 9 hedge accounting. And I know we try to be quite careful not to call this hedge accounting. That's why we call this dynamic risk management, because it is different. But I think to the extent we've got similar ideas and we mean them in a similar way, that can be helpful for thinking. And so I like, for example, the fact that we have this idea of the risk management strategy and risk management objectives, which I think is similar logic to IFRS 9, and I think similar to IFRS 9, if you change your strategy, that's a really big deal that has dramatic effects, just as it does in IFRS 9, where you have to discontinue hedge accounting in 9, similar idea there. So I really encourage us to try and... I think this is really complicated for everybody, including specialists, and so the more that we can use... We certainly should use the same ideas using the same language and make sure we don't use the same words to mean different things. And I think that's what we're doing. So I think that's a really positive thing. Then a couple of observations and suggestions. And this is around, I think, just wording, but also something for you guys to think about, if I could. And this is, we've got this notion in here about reducing risk. And I agree with this notion of reducing risk, and I think it's a helpful safeguard for the reasons that you guys point out in the paper, that you're not sort of starting to create risk and pretending it's a benign activity. But we talk in the paper about reducing interest rate risk, and the challenge with, you know, hedging activities, not the accounting, but the actual hedging, is you reduce one type of risk and you often... introduce another type of risk. So I take away cash flow variability by hedging floating rates, but I introduce fair value variability. So, you know, it's not a total neutral risk, you know, decision. And when I asked the staff about this, when you came back to me, you used far more specific wording to respond to my question, and I think we need to use that far more specific wording, because we mean a very particular type of interest rate risk. You mean reducing repricing risk due to interest rate changes. We need to say that everywhere, even though it's boring. I think we need to be very precise, because otherwise it's not a totally true statement, I think, in its shortened form. But on that, sort of the thing to think about, and I think it's okay, but I want to flag it because I know that historically for the board it's been a really big deal. So I think it's right to say that if you pick up the hedge accounting requirements in IFRS 9, we don't typically use this sort of notion of reducing risk. And the reason why the board didn't use that notion of reducing risk, even though hedging is about obviously reducing risk, is because it depends, you know, it can change risk, and so it's reducing the risk you want to manage, but it can give rise to other risks. That was one reason. But the other reason the board was also very careful about it is that if you look at a particular hedging relationship, you might be reducing risk looking at that particular population that you're looking at, but if you were to look at the entity more generally, you may have actually created risk. Or if you looked at the, you know, not just the subsidiary but at the group, it may have a different effect. So for example, you might have if you looked at the whole group, banking group, maybe the net open position is actually different to looking at the particular thing that you're hedging. And so I think we just need to be careful that it's very clear that we're talking about reducing repricing risk due to interest rates in the context of the particular population that you're focusing on. I think, again, that works, but if you guys could just check that we're not saying something there that's a different logic to what we've used in the past, but that would just make me feel a bit more secure. Another one that I think is wording, but also watching history, is this notion of evidencing the risk mitigation intention, looking at the actual derivatives that have been entered into. I think I know what you mean there, but given our difficult history with cash flow hedge accounting, where there was a lot of confusion, even with very, very sophisticated accountants, about the extent to which you could just use the derivatives, the hypothetical, to do all your measurement, and that, treat that as though that were the only thing you needed to worry about. And we went out of our way in IFRS 9 with a lot of bruises to show for it to be very clear that you actually need to directly measure the hedged risk and then the hypothetical derivative as part of a measurement exercise. You can't just sort of impute from those derivatives to things. I think similarly here, we have this notion of the risk mitigation intention, which would imply a particular set of derivatives that needs to be entered into. If you haven't actually been able to execute the perfect derivatives, we need to, I think, make sure that we're not implying that those two things are being merged. And I don't think that's what we mean, but I think we're going to have to be very careful in the way that we articulate it. And that then leads me to my question, because I have to say that I think I'm at risk of being confused, because I had thought that if you had a disconnect between the sort of perfect, for want of a better word, set of derivatives that would mitigate to get to your risk mitigation intention, and there was a disconnect between that and the actual derivatives that you'd entered into, just because sometimes you can't get, there's cost reasons or whatever for why you might do something slightly different. Maturities might not be perfect and all those sorts of things. I thought that would show up as a form of noise, if you like, for want of a better word, but I'm not sure that the staff agreed when they responded to me.
No, I think it would. But there's, I think, the one thing, and I know we need to work on that, and we will definitely do that for next discussions, is there are several sources of misalignment in this model. And not all of that misalignment would necessarily end up in P&L because we are using the lower of mechanics.
That's fine. We need to get to where it shows up. But yes. In concept, it shows up.
Yeah. And I think also what we want to try and look at is, even if you've got misalignment that's not recognized in P&L, that is still useful information about, what you're doing for risk management and how successful you've been in achieving what you set out to do. And that's why, as Jin Chao mentioned, we might be looking at some disclosure requirements or something around how to capture that misalignment that didn't end up in P&L because of the mechanics.
That makes me feel better. I was wondering if I was in my own little planet there for a moment. Thank you.
Mary.
I think, like Sue, I have a number of comments and maybe follow-ups that are in the context of, feels like overall we're heading in, in the right direction. And I'm afraid probably my questions are not as insightful as hers. But also I want to endorse something she was saying. I think we need to be brutally clear about things in this document. And, so going back to, I think, I can't remember if it was today or Jin Zhao was saying about the external derivatives evidencing. I think we have to make it absolutely clear that this is a model that applies only for external hedging, that you don't get DRM on the basis of internal derivatives. And I think that's important that we be very direct about, even if we think it's a statement of the obvious. So that's one example. But then maybe going to more kind of complex areas, the retrospective testing and the frequency of the retrospective testing. In the paper, it talks about the beginning of the period and the change from the beginning of the period to the end of the period. And, Rihanna, one of the things you helpfully clarified for me offline, is that the period isn't necessarily the financial reporting period. It's the period since you last set your risk management intention. But when I think about that, so that goes to the frequency of testing. We'll go back to the frequency with which you adjust your risk management intention. But I'm going to do something very dangerous, which is try to describe a graphic in words. If I think about your risk management intention, it basically defines a shaded band, on a time axis, and it says basically our intention, or even a line, because it's a risk management intention. The target profile is the band, and then the risk management intention is the line within that band. I still am not sure that I see why you would just look at the beginning and end of period as opposed to looking at your position for whatever that period duration is to see if you crossed the line or not. Because, you may end up, let's say, with unexpected prepayments, unexpected additions to the portfolio, et cetera. And while you can get it back to the line, or within the line by the time you test it, if you've gone out, if you crossed the line, wouldn't you, during that period, wouldn't you want to pick that up too? So that, I guess that's, I'm not asking for a, could you please explain right here how that works, but could we think about whether our expression of focus on beginning of period and end of period would omit capturing some misalignment that occurs during the period that has reversed by the time we get to the end of the period. So that's just kind of one, can you think about that? A second thing, and this kind of goes back to brutal clarity, is I am, you make the point about the changes being applied prospectively. So let's say you have a certain portfolio. The reason that you would have unexpected changes is you might, two examples are unexpected prepayments or maybe even generating more, I'm going to use the assumption of loans that get added into that portfolio. And so therefore you have a different net open position than you expected. I'm assuming that when you're adding loans in, that they are only added in prospectively. And again, I think we just have to make it very clear that that's one of the things that's subject to that prospective only, because it means that you can't, it's one of the disciplines. And I think it would be consistent with how I would expect somebody to undertake their risk, interest rate risk management strategy, repricing. But I just think we have to be absolutely clear. Now, going back to my graphic of the band and the line within the band, you've made a point about how the two retrospective tests, the independent retrospective tests, are an additional discipline for getting meaningful information about the performance of the risk management strategy. If the consequences of either crossing the line of the risk management initiative or going outside the band of the target profile are the same, i.e., it generates misalignment, and the risk management intention always has to be within the band, I'm not sure why we would test it twice. I could see testing it twice if there were different consequences for going outside the target profile than there would be from crossing the line of the risk management intention. And I understand that they might apply for different periods, but if one has always got to be within the other, I mean, if you think about it as road speed, if, the speed limit in London may be 30, no more than 35, but there's certain areas where it's 20. So long as you monitor whether you're within 20, you're going to be within 35. Mm-hmm. It, just just the mass. So that's something that I'm not seeing why it's an additional, why it's necessary and why it's an additional discipline. So that, I don't know if you want to comment.
I can maybe briefly comment on that. I think the reason for that is we say when you designate your risk management intention, it has to be between those two bands. But because you might be adding things during the day or things might disappear, that's the biggest risk. You know, there's more prepayments, things disappear off the book. And so now when you look at your risk management intention, it could move your whole position outside of those bands. And it is the effect of those unexpected changes that we are trying to capture. So it's not to say that, you know, most days it might stay within the band even if things gets added, but it's those times when there's such a big change to the book during that period that it moves the whole book outside of those bands.
But if the consequence of moving the whole book outside those bands is the same, that it gives rise to misalignment, then why would you be measuring the amount of misalignment at any amount that other than the difference versus the single line? So that's why I don't see why you'd have to measure it twice.
Because I think if you move your exposure outside these bands, you're going to be far more misaligned. So one test of misalignment is just going to be the difference between the actual derivatives and the benchmark derivatives. But that could be, you know, a small portion of all of this. There's quite big consequences for the bank moving outside of its risk limits. And I think that is useful information to know. You've gone outside of, that's why we want to capture that misalignment that attributes to that.
Okay, so then I think we need to bring out that one of the things that we're trying to capture and not only disclose, but I think also recognize and measure is the extent to which you have come outside of your target profile, because that's another layer of information about success with the risk management strategy. And then I think the last point, and this is just using me as a test case for clarity and understandability for the less sophisticated user of DRM, and I'm not sure that there are going to be a lot of readers of DRM who are the less sophisticated readers, is the the lower of is doing my head in a bit right now, so I think it's going to come back to having an example. I mean, it was very helpful to put the comment in the paper that reminded us of what the IS-39 lower of test is, but when I looked at that again and tried to use that as my anchor, that is limiting the amount that gets recognized in OCI and therefore excluded from P&L. Okay. And in my inference from reading some of the papers, almost feels like we're thinking in the DRM model about using the lower of to limit the amount that is recognized in P&L as misalignment. And I guess I'm struggling to see how that is a discipline. I mean, I've gone through and I understand why we say we don't want to recognize an amount that's greater than the hedged, in effect, than the hedged risk, and I'm sure I'm butchering it, you know, talking ad hoc about it. But so I get the fundamental need for something like the lower of test and importing that concept, but at least the way it's discussed, it almost seems to be constraining the wrong feature. So I'm assuming that that's a struggle on my part to understand exactly how it's being effective in achieving that objective. So that's maybe something to think about in terms of clarity of communication of what we're setting out to do with that and how it comes into play and fits in with the other pieces.
You mean the same thing.
Okay.
So it's always an interesting subject for me. I like the papers you brought us at the September and at the September meeting and this meeting with the precisions contained in the paper for a subject that is quite complicated and for me at least unusual or of which I have no practice. I mean, they are quite clear as far as I understood the content. I have two questions. One on paragraph 48. It will probably follows Tadeo's question. Let's assume that you have your example, which is perfectly clear. So the net risk position is currency unit 400, and let's assume that a bank will decide to hedge currency unit 200, meaning leaving unhedged currency unit 200. This currency unit 200 would be both a gross and a net. It's still within, it's a net because it's within the net risk position, but it could be also considered as being hedged as a gross position of an asset, for instance, in this example. So it's a gross within a net. Is it something that would be precluded, or do you consider that this would be acceptable within the models, the model you have in mind?
I think what we mean is that in this DRM model, because you've combined everything to arrive at your net position, you're not looking at individual items. So I cannot say this 200 that I'm deciding to hedge in your example is represented by these assets, and therefore I'm going to. Then you're not in DRM. I mean, that's kind of the proxy hedging that we are doing today, and, you know, whether you can do that under IFRS 9 still, you know. But that's not the DRM hedge. So I think we're talking within DRM. I'm not hedging individual items. I'm hedging a net position or part of a net position.
Okay. And then when you're talking, the second question is the when you're talking about buckets, I understood that the buckets are the maturities of the exposition. Am I correct in understanding that? Yes.
Repricing. Yeah.
I mean, you're not, to be very specific, you're not having in mind annual calls, for instance. No. just to make it very clear.
Nick? Thank you, and thank you to the staff for this paper. I found it very helpful, building on the September paper. And although there are various complexities, I'm sure implementation has its complexities. I mean, in underlying terms, I think the idea is very intuitive, it's straightforward, it better captures the economics of risk management activities. So I welcome all of that. And then I turned particularly to the benefits section, and particularly paragraph 50 I'm looking at, which talks about, as a result, preparers will find it easier to explain the DRM results in their financial statements, as the DRM model would more closely reflect the risk management activities of an entity. And really just to put down a marker here, because in terms of what I read today, without having discussed disclosures, I think what the model will allow preparers to better explain is their movements in net interest income. And the critical piece will be the disclosures as to whether you can give insight into the risk management activities of the entity. I don't want to discuss what in detail what those could be today, but I think that will make a difference, whether this is just a black box to users or whether they have insight into the actual risk management activities.
Thank you. I think that's a fair comment because it's all happening under the hood, right? Yeah. Right. Lika.
Thank you. Thank you, staff. I think this month's paper responded to my question I asked at the previous meeting, and then it's very convincing, and I feel more comfortable with having this early mind model. And as a board member, already mentioned a lot, so I just have a request to the staff. You have a word change, amend, adjust in the same paper, and some of the words are actually interchangeable each other. So if we finally decided, or when we communicate with the outside table, it would be very helpful to use a consistent word as much as possible. because if those words are translated into different language, if we use a different word, that means that they look for the different word in their language, although we consider that's interchangeable. So that will help the and improve the understandability of our work. Thank you.
I want to congratulate the staff. Thought it was a great paper, set of papers, and the improvements to the model or refinements to the model as we've been going, I think are setting us on a very good direction. So with that in mind, I think I have three things I want to talk about to think about for the future as we go forward. But before I say that, I'll say my background is as a financials analyst. And one of the key things one of my first mentors told me is for financial companies, it's not interest rate risk that kills you. It's the dumb things you do to avoid interest rate risk that kill you. And so that sets the context for some of my recommendations. And the first sort of hits at Sue's point, which is one of the things I honed in on was this difference between the actual derivatives you have in your book, the benchmark derivative, and the risk management intention. And I think there's important informational content in there, and we should be thinking as we go forward, not just about explaining what happened through the backwards test, you know, what happened last period, but if there's informational content in those differences, thinking about communicating those beforehand, recognizing that the periods that companies use might be one day, it might be half a day, they might be a week, or they could be a quarter. But there is informational content that we should think about on a prospective basis, not just on a backward basis. The second thing was a limitation of the model that you mentioned comes from several years ago, which is in thinking about these time buckets that Bertrand mentioned. One of the inherent limitations that we set before was that you couldn't overhedge within an individual time bucket. And I think that's likely to provoke discussion. I think a lot of companies right now actually have models where instead of hedging within each time bucket, they actually overhedge one bucket. But that does create risks. And so you can see why we set up the model and made the decision we did. You can see why companies might use the risk management strategies they have in terms of getting good prices at good points. I think it'll be interesting in the discussion going forward to see how much we need to flex our assumption, if at all. I don't want to say we have to, without creating blind spots for users. Because going back to that point about creating risk versus the risk inherent in the portfolio, things don't move in parallel on the interest rate curve. They twist, they move around, and sometimes you can actually add to the risk by creating these basis differences in how you're hedging against that limiting factor. And then the last one, and I talked a little bit about this with the team when they helped me understand the model better, was I want to make sure going forward that we have an inherent concept that we're just adding derivatives, even to offset positions. And I want us to think through carefully what happens if derivatives are sold, because that could trigger certain things in the P&L, AOCI, and make sure that we're robust in the model to sales versus just adding, so that you can't create accounting effects by engaging in transactions in different ways. But again, I'm very supportive and think the work to date has been great.
Anne? I have a question, and it's about paragraph 53. And I'd like to understand better. So what you tell us in paragraph 53 is that the way we're developing the DRM model and the components of the model contribute to the reduction in proxy hedging. And you tell us three ways in which the proposed model contribute to the reduction in proxy hedging. So does this mean that the features distinguish the features of the model we're developing distinguish from what was done previously? So under this model, people won't be able to do that type of proxy hedging that they did before? Is that how we're setting up the model? So in this model, you say these are the features of the model that contribute to the reduction in proxy hedging, but that's because the model is different, so people can't do the proxy hedging? Or is it about for people that are going to use the model will be more attractive and they won't want to do proxy hedging? Or is it some combination of both?
So I think we are not saying you cannot do proxy hedging, right? And you know, like the example like Bertrand gave, if you're outside the DRM model and, you know, you have to designate things on a gross basis, then, you know, maybe proxy hedging works in that case. I think all we're saying is that within this model, you no longer have to do proxy hedging to reflect your risk management activities. You can now directly reflect what you're doing because you can designate the net position instead of going to look for gross positions to make up that net position, basically. And I think that's what we mean, is you don't have to hedge something else to get the same results as if you've hedged this thing, because now you can hedge this thing that you want to hedge.
So that the model, as we're proposing, should be more attractive to preparers.
We hope.
Sort of, yeah, you sort of had a nod there. So in theory, it should be more attractive. So do we have any sense that people will still want to stay with prior practice, or is that just something we haven't thought about yet?
I think we had some initial feedback from banks, and I think it's interesting the difference between when you talk to the risk managing team in the bank, they completely agree this reflects what they are doing and it's great. The accountants, I think, sometimes have a bit of trouble to let go of what they've been doing in the past. But I think the one good thing we have heard is that people are saying, yes, this will enable them to better reflect their risk management activities. But it will also kind of limit some of the opportunities they have currently to decide how much and where you want to, you know, to achieve a certain outcome, which I think is a good thing, although they might not necessarily agree.
Okay, thank you. Just to build on this, I think the real, and it goes back to a conversation that we had with Bertrand earlier in the week, I was going to say last time, but it's just this week, isn't it? about you know, the sweet spot. When we can get an alignment between what we're requiring for accounting and what's actually happening in terms of how the business is being managed, I think we've got a much more, firstly, it's much more robust, I think, as a basis for accounting, because what this should enable us to do is actually directly build on risk management activity to support the accounting. And I think that is, if we can get that to work, that's always a more robust basis for the accounting. And I think it, you know, you would think it should be more interesting for investors as well, because it's a more direct reflection of what's actually going on in the business, as opposed to more of an accounting construct. And I think what we've got at the moment with proxy hedging is you can use proxy hedging in IFRS 9 and in IAS 39, but even in IFRS 9, as long as it's done in a way which is consistent with the risk mitigation objectives/strategy, it's not prohibited. But this makes it even more possible to more directly align how you designate the particular accounting with what the actual risk management is, and that's, I think, much more powerful. But Rihanna's right, that should be good, but there's room to wiggle in what there is now. So some, you know, and people have got very sophisticated systems set up to do that wiggling.
Never change your running system. Yeah. And it comes at a price. So my comments really build on your points and on Zach's points. Let me firstly say that I'm very appreciative where we've gone to so far. I hope that we can continue on that path. There are some big nets still to be cracked. And I think everything that I've seen so far actually makes me happier compared to where we are at this stage or where we have tried before. A couple of remarks, perhaps, because a few of you have commented about that period-to-period change. And I think we probably need to be clear as to what is a period. Because I could very well see that a period for this model might be a day. We should not forget, we are talking dynamic risk management. It's something that's happening on a continuous basis. A risk manager in a bank would not just open the day with what has my risk position been yesterday? Okay, let's now amass new risk. Let's now close down new risk. And let's look at the overall risk position tomorrow again. That's not what they're doing. It's a continuous exercise. But reporting is discrete. And the question is, how do we align the two? So if we want to inform people about what has happened between the beginning and the end of a period, the question is, what do we mean by period? Is that a reporting period? Is that the period where we have seen dynamic risk management? And I think the bridge can only be through disclosures. But then the question is, how much disclosures do you want to provide? Because you don't want to end up with a huge table that tells you for every day what really has happened. That's one bit where we just have to be conscious in managing our own expectations. We're trying to square the circle of putting a discrete presentation model in context with a continuous hedging or risk management model. The second bit related to something that Zach was pointing out, and I think he's exactly right. He's also right with the phrase about doing the dull things about not being or being risk averse. No risk, no fun. I mean, that holds for interest rate risk as well. If you want to close down all your risk, by definition, you can't make any profit, right? Mm-hmm. So it's only the question as to how much you want to let through and which type you want to let through. But I want to come back to something that he said. It may be that some of the changes are actually inadvertent changes that are not endogenous to the entity. And he's given one example that I absolutely agree with. It may be that you see twists of the interest rate curve. And that surely will have an impact on where the cash flows landed as per your assumption and where they actually landed in the buckets. And there's little that you can do about it. I mean, the market is a market. What we are really concerned about, I think, is if the market stays constant, the bank fiddles around. That's the bit where we say you are actually changing something. But that is always overpowered by the developments that we are seeing outside of the bank that are happening, right? And it could be a shift, it could be a change, it could be a twist, it could be all sorts of things. And this is where I thought that Sue was right in reminding us that we need to be careful when we talk about hedging or eliminating risks, because that's something, by definition, every risk manager will tell you you can't do. By eliminating, you open simultaneously another risk position. What you're doing is a risk conversion. You're closing one sort of risk, but you're obviously opening up a different one. And the one piece where I wasn't entirely sure whether our statement was correct was where we say every time that an entity actually sees an increase in a risk in a bucket, it has a consequence. And I wasn't sure whether we really meant this in that way. Because it could be that there are changes, as I said, there are exogenous, and the entity can't really do anything. And I mean, if they are seeing that they are going beyond the line, as Mary pointed, they will surely act, right? They don't wait for the trouble to hit the fan, but really they would see that, acknowledge this, assess it, and say we bring it back to below the line. I mean, so the question is, when should that reassessment take place? Is it at the point in time where actually one of two things happen? Either you reach the end of the period that you assign, you would do the testing or the assessment, or is it probably a sooner point in time that is where you decide to act and to change and to, for instance, change your derivatives position or to bring the risk back to below the line? And the one area, I think, where you can't do that is probably the last bucket. Because if you think of buckets, it's a very neat assumption, yeah? You have 40 buckets all lined up. But the thing is, the buckets move. And the question is, what do you keep static? Do you keep static the buckets and you take out the cash flow from one bucket to the next lower bucket because the trade gets closer to maturity? Or do you let all the buckets move on the time horizon? But that would mean, inadvertently, that you always add another bucket at the very end, right? And that's the only bucket that you can't really control. Because by definition, if you look at your current portfolio, you have something that's maturing tomorrow, and there's something that's, say, maturing in 20 years. But if tomorrow there will be another trade that's maturing in 20 years, it will differ from the one that you designed yesterday, because that's no longer now 20 years, it's 19 years and 363 days, right? So the question is, how do we go about the movement of cash flows and the movement of trades as the time progresses? And that adds back to probably Mary's point that she was making. These are my two comments, and this is not to say you haven't thought about it, shame on you. It's just to flag that these are issues that I think we will have to dwell on as we progress.
So I completely agree with you on those issues, and I think, you know, quite difficult issues to deal with. I think some of that, there has been discussions in the past in coming up with a core model in terms of, you know, you've got future, you know, things are going to roll off, you're going to add them at the end. So you always have a sort of a 20-year or a, you know, 40 buckets in your example position, but the exposure within each bucket changes as things roll on. But I think we know we need to come back to that because there's questions around what goes into each bucket, what are you allowed to do and all of that. But we were planning on doing that once we have got these bare bones of the model and what we want to achieve, what we think the model should achieve. Once we've figured that out and we've got agreement on that, it's easier to think about all these other nitty-gritty things that, you know, make up the whole model. So there's still a lot of work, I think, to be done in this model, and we are aware of that. We're just trying to figure out what are the key elements we need in the model, and then we can build the flesh around it, which will come to some of these issues that you've raised, but also some of what Zach and Mary has raised.
Okay.
Baby steps.
So I think with these comments, I heard a lot of appreciation. So I think we are ready to vote on the question in this paper after paragraph 59. Let's see a show of hands who agrees with the staff recommendation to make the refinements.
12.
Very good. So that takes us to the next paper. Lira?
Okay. All right. Moving on to 4B. So this paper considers the issue of what portion of a portfolio of prepayable assets should be designated in DRM model if an entity manages only a portion and not the entire portfolio as part of its dynamic risk management. So when developing the core model, the board tentatively decided to allow entities to use a percentage approach to determine this portion, provided that that percentage is consistent with the entity's risk management strategy and activities. As we reported back in April during outreach, participants said that from risk management perspective, that portion is not determined as a percentage of individual assets in the portfolio. Instead, it is determined based on a number of factors, including the entity's expectation of what would be the stable portion of those prepayable assets. In terms of potential solution, most respondents suggested the board consider the bottom layer approach as one way that, in their view, it could address this problem. However, from staff perspective, instead of considering the suggested approach, we focused our analysis on what are the actual risk management activities that an entity undertakes when it decides the extent of risk it wants to mitigate. As we discuss in paragraphs 17 to 20, we concluded that the refinements discussed in paper 4A already enable an entity to consider the expected prepayment profile as part, if that's consistent with their risk management activities. And particularly, if an entity consistent with their risk management strategy manages the repricing risk of a stable portion of repayable assets based on the expected prepayment profile, they would be able to reflect that activity through the current net open risk position. In addition, the risk mitigation intention discussed in paper 4A reflects the fact that sometimes entities mitigate only an extent of the open risk position to achieve their target profile rather than the entire current net open risk position. And so in our view, All this means that there is no need for an entity to seek an approach such as the bottom layer to reflect these risk management activities. And for that reason, we are not recommending making any refinements to DRM model with regards to this particular issue. Just to be clear, we're not suggesting that the risk mitigation intention is in essence the bottom layer. In our view, the two concepts are different for many reasons, including the fact that the bottom layer is best identified in a portfolio of when an entity designates gross possessions of individual portfolios, rather than net open risk position, which is the basis on which the risk mitigation intention is determined. All we're saying here is that if in deciding how much of the risk to mitigate, an entity's risk management activity involves reflecting the expected prepayment levels, then the refinements discussed in paper 4A enable an entity to reflect those risk management activities. With that, I'll hand over to the board to discuss and vote on question in page 7.
Thank you, Vera. Comments? Questions?
Just
to encourage
the discussion.
Jefferson,
yeah.
Not to leave you alone.
It is a practical question. What I understood that what we have discussed in paper 4A is that this is enough to cover the concerns that we are discussing here in 4B. I'm just trying to figure out whether those that propose using this bottom layer would agree with that, to say that if I might have other things in my, because DRM model comprises all assets and liabilities in a net position. And then I understood that the request was trying to isolate this specific bit in the portfolio. And once we say that, no, the general idea will cover this one, but I might have my piece of caution, if I can tell this difference, that might be bite by other unexpected chains in other assets and liabilities. I'm just wondering whether, if going back to those that ask it for this bottom layer approach, they would say, are you sure that I can't really, for this specific bit, have a specific treatment and not try to put this all together and avoid some contamination of these unexpected changes eating part of my cushion in the prepayments? Is it a fair comment? I mean, that I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes of those that think that we should treat this differently.
So if your question is whether people that use the bottom layer as a way to say, I never have to worry about unexpected prepayments because I've built in a buffer in what I've designated, and therefore from an accounting perspective, I never have any ineffectiveness in this regard, then, you know, I don't think they would be happy with this. But that's not what we are trying to achieve, because even in those entities where they say from accounting perspective, I don't want to think about unexpected changes, I don't want to worry about that. That's not what risk management does, because risk management has to manage the risk. And if there's, you know, if there's a change in the risk, they have to, as Andreas explained, they have to monitor it and act on it. So from a risk management perspective, you wouldn't say, I want to leave this unhedged or, you know, unmitigated just because I don't want to recognize anything in accounting. I mean, the risk management don't think about what ends up in the financial statement. So I think that's why we're saying, if you're in the second bucket, which is just doing it for accounting outcome purposes, then we don't think the model should cover or cater for that. But if you're really trying to determine what is the expected repricing and what portion of my book, I might have a 20-year mortgage book, but, you know, in the UK, average life of a mortgage is 7 years. So you allocate your assets into the 7-year buckets and not the 20-year buckets. That's fine, and that's what we require you to do. And if you say that's a bottom layer, then, you know, I don't think it is, but
That's not what we want you to do. We don't want you to say, I've got a seven-year book, but really I'm just going to hedge 3 years because I can't be bothered with checking for unexpected changes. That's the bit that we don't want to allow.
Thank you. Tom?
To answer your question, in the paper, I have the impression, yes, but I will have to, honestly, I will have to double check, but to be with the French banks, whether or not it's okay within the boundaries of the model you've described in both paragraph 4A and 4B. But I have the impression that I agree with the staff view, yes, on the principle, but then to be double checked. That's just my question. I think on this issue, and it will echo a bit of the concerns expressed by Tadeo also, we will need to double check with those concerns.
We will. Bruce.
Thanks. I don't know if you've kind of answered a bit of it. I guess I was just, when I went through it, I was just trying to tie in the paper A, 4A in this, in terms of, I mean, am I wrong in understanding? I mean, this is really a question around your asset profile designation. I mean, if I decide to take the separate portfolio of my bottom layer, effectively set that up, I mean, I can achieve the accounting I want in terms of this. So I've got the ability to, I don't want to use the word manipulate, but got the ability to do the accounting I want, kind of achieving this if I really wanted to anyway. Am I correct in terms of that? Designating my lower level as a separate portfolio.
I think yes and no, because ultimately, again, we're saying, you know, DRM is driven by risk management. So what are you looking from a risk management perspective in managing together? That's the whole thing that people have always been saying why we need a DRM model is we look at risk holistically across all these books. We don't look at the books in, you know, individually. So
agreed, yeah.
So I think, and maybe it comes down to what we at some stage in the future decide about, you know, is the model mandatory, is it voluntary, and all of those things. But yes, in theory,
I'm just going to say, so my understanding is if somebody really wanted to use this kind of bottom layer approach, they could achieve that. So that doesn't faze me. I guess what I was just trying to work out is, I mean, if what we're really talking about here is were you talking about the percentage? You're saying a percentage of the assets that I've designated or the percentage of the net position? The net position. So I'd have to manipulate the asset. Okay, then I'm going to say that. Thank you.
Kika?
When I participated in outreach meeting, yeah, I remember that some banks like to ask us to consider a use of the bottom layer approach. But at the same time, I don't think use of bottom layer approach itself is indispensable, because what they think is the use of bottom layer approach could provide a better reflection of the economics of what they have in hand. So if the mechanism of risk mitigation intention and in our model can provide a similar or better reflection of what they have in hand, in that case, I prefer without pursuing a bottom layer approach and pursuing our approach further. And then I would like to make sure with our stakeholders, especially bank, understand that this is a thing that works in practice.
I'm going to ask you a little bit of an odd question, but let me lead up to it. So I think I read this paper and it all looks totally logical and it looks incredibly straightforward. But I know that this whole bottom layer question has been a huge sticking point between the board and the banks over the years, and almost a religious war at times between, I think, the board and the market. So my question to you is, if John Smith was sitting at this table, how would he respond to this paper? And I ask you that because I always had the sense, John was a very, very smart guy when it came to hedge accounting and the economic side of things. And I don't think that my sense was he wasn't focused on accounting manipulation or masking of things. So I don't think the thing that we're talking about in here was really what he was focused on.
I always had the sense he really believed that there was an economic disconnect that needed to be captured, and that for him and people like him, bottom layer was key in capturing that. So if John was here today, what do you think his response to this paper would be?
So, I...
you called John.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I haven't. I don't know John as well as you do, but if his concern was that you have to capture the economic effect of what's happening through the bottom layer, then I think our model does exactly that. There's, I think people are using the term bottom layer to refer to different things, and I think that's part of the risk. Is one part of is you talk about the bottom layer, meaning I don't work on the contractual maturities of assets that are prepayable. I work on the expected repayments on those assets because I know I'm not going to have a 20-year mortgage on the book for 20 years, so I'm not hedging it for 20 years. I'll only have it for 7 years or 5 years, and therefore I hedge that. That's what our model does. But some other people are talking about bottom layer in the sense that any prepayments coming out of my book, I'm going to assume is coming out of the unhedged portion, because up until now we've designated individual items as part of our hedges. So I'm going to assume that any prepayment is out of the unhedged portion and my bottom layer is the stable bit. Now, if you look at on an individual item, you cannot say that because you don't know which asset sits where. But it works in a portfolio basis because I'm just looking at how much of my portfolio that I've got do I think I'm going to get in 7 years, and that's the bit that I've got. So I think I'm hoping, and I hope that you would agree that, you know, our model captures the economic effect of it, but that's it.
I might send them the paper in case it's bored.
Just a really quick question. Does the FASB thing on multiple layers have any impact on this at all?
Yes, I think we've spoken to the FASB staff this week to understand where they are and what they do and how they look at it, and I think they are doing something similar to what we've got in the portfolio fair value hedge. Kind of, it's a closed book. Therefore, they are looking not at the dynamic book like we are, but they're looking at the old style of, it's a closed portfolio, and therefore they are building something in like a bottom layer, kind of last of layer approach in that to capture the economics that Sue just mentioned. But it's slightly different model, so it's slightly different objectives as well.
The way that you look at the hedged item matters a lot.
Okay, so I then draw your attention to the question in the paper after paragraph 24. Do we agree as far as you set out? Can I see a show of hands?
12.
Well done, team. Okay, can I suggest that we break for 15 minutes and reconvene at 10:45, please?